Hi, I'm Jillian Caldwell-Clark, and you're listening to the second episode of Bespoke, a podcast and project about the media and how it works. During the 2016 election, an old quote attributed to Donald Trump popped up. The quote read, "If I were to run, I'd run as a Republican. They're the dumbest group of voters in the country. They believe anything on Fox News. I could lie and they'd still eat it up. I bet my numbers would be terrific." The quote was said to have come from a 1998 interview Trump supposedly did with People magazine. I saw it from the social media accounts of boomer liberals I knew, who were excitedly sharing the quote with their feed as a bit of, "See, we told you." Here's the thing. Trump never did an interview with People magazine in 1998. The quote has been debunked several times since it first became popular in 2015, and yet every once in a while, I still see it on my Facebook feed. Misinformation and disinformation affect both liberals and conservatives. Democrat, Republican, or neither, we're all susceptible to it. The United Nations defines misinformation as false or inaccurate information accidentally spread. Disinformation is defined as the deliberate or malicious spread of false information, like a hoax or a piece of propaganda meant to spread fear within its audience or population. In this example, the misinformation relies on something called confirmation bias, which basically means people will always inadvertently look for or believe information that aligns with the beliefs they already hold. And misinformation and disinformation are just a few pieces of the very large and confusing puzzle we're trying to put together when we consider how we're influenced by the media we consume and why it matters. Misinformation and disinformation are two terms I'm sure you've heard at least once before that people use when discussing how messy our media landscape has become. And there's certainly more. But first, we're going to talk a little bit about theory. And I'm sorry for that, but it must be done, and I promise to make it as painless as possible. To talk about the theories around media effects, or media effect theories, we're going to start with World War I, everybody's second favorite world war. In the United States, the Committee on Public Information, or CPI, was created during the First World War to influence the public's opinion around the war effort. As René Diresta writes, "Propaganda was a tool of influence operations, formalized efforts to weaken the resolve of the enemy or to create support and resilience on the home front." The United States was not the only country making such efforts during wartime, and with the popularization of radio within the last 20 years or so, it was easier than ever to reach your audience. One of the men on the CPI was Edward Bernays, a man who would go on to make an indelible mark on American society and who is now known as the grandfather of public relations. A nephew of the famed Sigmund Freud, Bernays had an early interest in psychology and persuasion techniques. Through his work with the CPI, Bernays became convinced that it was the moral obligation of communicators to spread helpful propaganda that shaped public opinion and a general consensus. He believed that propaganda was an essential good for democracies, writing in his 1928 book, Propaganda, that the conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. At the time, the term propaganda did not necessarily have the same negative connotations that it has today. That didn't really take hold until World War II. And by that time, Bernays had rebranded his particular form of intelligent manipulation as public relations. Now, how did Bernays use his powers of intelligent manipulation? In 1929, he designed a campaign for Lucky Strike to get women to smoke more cigarettes. Framing cigarettes as torches of freedom, Bernays used the momentum from the passage of the 19th Amendment to make smoking an act of feminist rebellion. This was while his own wife was not allowed to smoke because of the health risks. He also popularized bananas in the United States, in part by helping in the takedown of a democratically elected government in Guatemala. I'm very serious, and we don't have time to go into it right now, but please look it up. Bernays' time with the CPI and his subsequent crowning as the first real king of American advertising all took place during the same time academics began to really dive into something called media effects theory. And media effects theory is what we study when we discuss how and why mass media affects the general population. It started to be discussed formally in the 1920s after World War I, made a lot of world leaders very nervous and or excited, depending on your vibe, about the possible uses for propaganda. At the time, people like Edward Bernays and Walter Lippmann, a journalist and sometimes mentor to Bernays, put their weight behind a theory referred to as the hypodermic needle approach. This was the idea that you could take one message, put it in a radio or on the front of a newspaper, and people would get it and believe it right away. Such a theory relied heavily on the power media had to persuade. By the middle of the 20th century, it became clear that the passing back and forth of information and messages was much more complicated than that. In other words, it became clear that you cannot just give the public a message through a needle, like a vaccine. There are other factors involved. Paul Lazarfield came up with an information model called two-step flow. This idea puts more emphasis on how the news is spread. It is the idea that one person hears the news and then tells another person, spreading the information in a two-step process. In the mid-1950s, Paul Lazarfield and his partner conducted a study that looked at a group of what they thought of as influential women in the town of Decatur, Illinois. Katz and Lazarfield observed how these 800 women processed what they heard in the media and how they shared that information with the community. From their findings within this experiment, the researchers noted that people should be studied as a communicator and as a relay point in the network of mass communication. Another popular theory saw the media as a gatekeeper of sorts. Instead of the media being a vehicle for one message that reaches audiences and convinces them of that messaging, it provides a sort of direction for audiences as to what they should be thinking about. This is referred to as agenda setting. While the connection between media and the salient issues in the public consciousness was made in the 1920s by Walter Lippmann, it wasn't until a 1972 study was conducted by Maxwell McCombs and Donald Shaw at UNC Chapel Hill that empirical evidence was found that supported this claim. Many studies in the 1970s and 1980s confirmed the media's power to highlight an issue within the public consciousness. Alongside the consideration of how media shapes issues and persuades audiences, scholars also look at how they then make their political decisions with what information they have. Today, I'm going to talk specifically about the writings of Samuel L. Popkins. In his book, The Reasoning Voter, Popkins argues that voters do make rational choices with the information they gather or are given. The rational choice of one voter, however, may not match the rational choice of another. Voters, Popkins reasons, collects information both from their day-to-day life, how much does a dozen eggs cost, how much did they pay for their child's insulin, and then their news media allows them to connect that personally gathered information to the information given to them about how the government is acting or what leaders are doing. Popkins also writes that voters look for connections in campaigns. This means that they look for symbols they can then assign attributes they are familiar with. These can be different for every voter, but there are some that stand out and that most of us recognize. For instance, we like to see politicians interact with babies or children, probably because we see that as a reassurance that they care about children. We then could say, oh, they care about children. They probably care about X, Y, and Z that we associate with protecting children. Obviously, this means different things for different people. And some people just don't do their research. In the book, Popkins goes on to write, if voters had a full understanding of the organization of government and no uncertainty about the policy choices candidates would make and no uncertainty about the result of government policies, they would be able to weigh all issues and assess the impact of each on future benefits. As we have seen, however, these conditions are never present. Voters consider only the few issues they can connect with particular offices and with results that they care about. And for a personal personal side note here, I think the political machine makes it very difficult for an everyday voter to do their research. It also does a really good job at making people feel stupid so they don't even start that research. If you have rent to pay, groceries to buy, and kids to raise, at the end of the day, you're not trying to be the most informed voter in your neighborhood. You're just trying to survive. Why would you then spend what precious free time you have looking into a system that makes you feel stupid? So that's a pretty basic review of some theory around how media and rhetoric affects us, how voters receive information from the media, and how much it matters, and what they might do with that information once they have it to make decisions. There's a lot more to it than what I've laid out here, and I hope that you'll do some extra research into anything that you might find interesting. Or don't. You don't have to do anything you don't want to do, and I'm just glad that you're here with me today. But obviously, this is all pretty complicated. We usually don't make decisions based off of just one political ad or flyer, but they also don't not have an effect on us. And it's not getting any simpler. It is, in fact, getting more complicated every day. Because now that we've looked at how media affects populations, we're going to look at the different lenses through which media can be manipulated or framed. Basically, we're going to take a peek at how the media that affects us is affected by other factors within the system at large. So step back with me for a second to the 1960s. With the war in Vietnam raging and young American men being drafted every day, a split took place between the media and the government. For the first time, major media news outlets reported something different than what the government had been telling the American people. This influenced not only the way the American people viewed the government, but also how they viewed the mass media. It began raising questions around how much the government and the media worked together previously. People began to question what Walter Lippmann called manufactured consent in his 1922 book I referenced earlier. For Lippmann, this manufactured consent wasn't necessarily a bad thing. It could be used as a way to educate the population and get everyone on board with an idea. However, not everyone saw it this way. And by the 1960s, enough had happened between the government and the American people in the public eye that a whole generation became wary of where and how they got their information. In the 1980s, Noam Chomsky and Edward S. Herman wrote Manufacturing Consent, The Political Economy of the Mass Media. In this work, they present five filters that they believe media goes through before reaching us, the normal everyday citizen. I'll go through them briefly now. The first filter is size, ownership, and profit orientation of the mass media. The second is the advertising license to do business. Back in the day, supposedly, newspapers could cover the cost of doing business just with how much they made off of sales of their product. The advertising model that we live with today gives advertisers the power over whether or not they choose to advertise with that media outlet. This means that they can choose not to advertise with a media outlet that perhaps spread news or printed something that they or their customer base disagree with. The third filter is sourcing mass media news. And this means that mass media gets their sources to look legitimate, to look like they know what they're talking about, from places like the government or corporations. You would rather have a quote from a confirmed public figure than some guy on Reddit. This means that media outlets have to play by the rules when it comes to institutions and public figures. The fourth filter is flack and the enforcers. Flack means the negative responses that a media outlet might get to a statement or program or story. Much of the time, media outlets have to weigh the pros and cons in publishing a story if it has to do with powerful people, especially if those powerful people do not care about freedom of press. When this model was created, the final fifth filter was anti-communism as a control mechanism. Today, we can still look at it as anti-communism as a control mechanism, but we can also look at it as finding a common enemy in order to get approval and sign off from the higher ups. The stories that they share and the programs that they produce have to recognize the common enemy within the public. Basically, who do we, the normal citizen, have to fear in order for the powerful to stay powerful? And obviously, these five filters, like I said, were presented in the 1980s, in a time before social media and before online news. So what has changed? In her book, Invisible Rulers, Professor of Media Renee DiResta breaks down the structures of two sources people have gotten information from for centuries, if not millennia. One is what she refers to as the rumor mill, something that has been present in every community since the beginning of time. Who's sleeping with who stole what from where? Traditionally, this has been peer-to-peer based. People talk, and while they talk, they spread information, whether they mean to or not. The second is what she refers to as the propaganda machine. This machine is made up of information the state gives and the mass media spreads. Some of the early propagandists I reference might have seen this as a tool for democratic utopia. However, in Chomsky and Herman's eyes, it is a means of control and possibly authoritarianism. As I said before, for the majority of the history of mass media, the state was able to give information to the mass media directly, and media would disseminate that information. However, even when the media was made up of elites and the American people were only able to make their dissatisfaction heard through protest or letter writing, they were never able to truly shape the messaging en masse outside of the traditional structure. DiResta posits that now those two things are interlinked, the propaganda machine and the rumor mill. On top of that, the age of digital media has turned how we receive information on its head. Now, instead of Americans receiving their news from a few legacy media groups, they can receive it from thousands, if not millions, of different sources. A lot of the gatekeeping that was once seen as necessary is now gone. People are less likely to pay for their news, and citizen journalism is more popular and more accessible than ever. DiResta writes in her book that technological transformation created communication structures that eliminated human gatekeepers from the process of curation, reducing the power of media elites. There's now a new level of participation in the reception and distribution of news. Instead of the powers that be disseminating one message, everyone is involved in the conversation. Instead of just receiving the news and then talking about it with someone in person, someone's opinion is already superimposed when they make a post on Facebook or Instagram. This is especially true for Gen Z, who get their news mostly from social media. A Pew Research Center found that 78% of people between the ages of 18 and 29 said they, at least sometimes, get their news from social media. 43% of people within that age group said they prefer to get their news from social media. And with social media comes other pieces of the ever-growing puzzle. So finally, let's talk about how these new media platforms work practically as businesses and as information disseminators, and how that affects what information is getting to our population today. If someone is getting their information from social media, they are getting their information from a business. Just not a business whose job it is to provide news. Like all businesses, spaces like Facebook, Instagram, or TikTok want to make money. The way they do that is by making sure you stay on their site as long as possible so they can show you as many ads as possible, or so they can collect as much data from you as possible. One early tool used to keep the audience engaged on their sites was personalized recommendations for groups or people to follow or friend that we might like. If you like tennis, and a lot of people who like tennis also like pickleball, you might be recommended pickleball. However, as Professor DiResta points out in her book, these recommendations can take a nefarious turn rather quickly. DiResta writes that in 2016, Facebook's internal research found that 64% of people who joined an extreme group did so by way of recommendation, and that groups were, as Jeff Horowitz of the Wall Street Journal put it, disproportionately influenced by a subset of hyperactive users. She goes on to write that in summer 2019, Facebook's internal research team set up a persona account, a politically conservative mother named Carol, and found that within 2 days, she too was being pushed into groups dedicated to QAnon. Today, if you were to go on to TikTok or Instagram, you might get what the algorithm believes you would find most engaging. This means that the algorithm learns from us and from people like us, and then offers what it thinks we would like based off of that information and data. Let's look at TikTok. A space where one survey from Common Sense Media, conducted with the University of Michigan's C.S. Mott Children's Hospital, found phone users 11 to 17 years old spend a median of 1 hour and 52 minutes every day. Studies have shown that liking or just watching videos on mundane topics can lead viewers on TikTok down a rabbit hole of right-wing media, extremism, or mis- and disinformation extremely quickly. I'm going to talk about one of the genres of videos I've found myself getting lost in, tradwife content. Please hold all judgments and questions for the Q&A section at the end. For those who are not aware, tradwives are these women who claim to have rejected neoliberal womanhood for what they perceive to be a simpler and more traditional way of life. I'm putting simpler and traditional in big quotation marks here. The stuff I usually watch is not overtly political. It's women like Nara Smith or maybe Hannah Nealman, aka Ballerina Farm. I watch them both with a sense of morbid curiosity and genuine enjoyment. They do videos like baking fresh bread in their million-dollar ovens or making goldfish from scratch. These two women in particular do not discuss their politics or religion that much. However, once you start watching them, you may get other recommendations of women doing similar things who do discuss those topics. In a 2024 study, Media Matters coded and analyzed 327 recommended videos after exclusively interacting with tradwife content. They found that their For You page was then flooded with medical misinformation, conspiracy theories, fear-mongering, and other right-wing messaging. For young men who are following a traditionally masculine set of interests, videos talking about weightlifting, dating, or finance could then make the algorithm recommend more and more content from the manosphere. Oh, what's the manosphere? I'm so glad you asked. I'll keep this super brief because we'll get into it a little bit more in the next episode. But the manosphere is what the collection of podcasts, YouTubers, and streamers making content specifically for boys and men is now being called. While some of this network can be pretty benign, the majority of the creators under this umbrella are known for spreading misogynistic content to their viewers, casually or otherwise. They were one of the topics focused on in all those articles about how young white men vote and how Trump won them over. And like I said, we'll go into that a little bit more in the next episode. But for right now, just understand that they play a pretty crucial role in the spread of information and message gathering of young men. They are the influencers for this population. The thing to keep in mind here is that influencers are very aware of the dynamics at play with the algorithm, or at least successful ones are. Professor DeResta writes in her book, "Influencers make content not for humans, but for the intersection of humans and algorithms." When it comes to interacting with and recruiting followers, influencers also have the ability to gain trust and perform authenticity in a way that makes their base listen to them and what they have to say. The bigger the audience and the more trust they gain, the more sponsors want them to try and sell their products or ideas. While there are some instances of influencers actually being paid to give their followers certain political messaging, the exchanging or selling of ideas online can also happen when an influencer finds a topic that then gets them more likes or views than normal. Sometimes the influencer might not believe in the idea they bring into the content initially or know that it won't play well, but it plays well in the sense that audiences watch it, whether it's out of anger, sadness, or enjoyment. And sometimes, the more they say it to get clicks, views, and likes, the more they themselves begin to believe it. Influencers make content they know will be boosted, and it's very difficult to figure out whether or not they actually believe in the ideologies they're supporting. Either way, they're making a lot of money off of it. For instance, by some estimates, Joe Rogan makes around $800,000 per episode of his wildly popular podcast. It's through this system of money and power that influencers and social media corporations make a lot of money off of the information you receive for free every day. Additionally, traditional forms of media pay attention to what influencers are now saying online and what becomes popular. Something you might have seen on X yesterday is now on Fox News tonight. It's no longer people talking about what they saw on the news, it's the news talking about what people on the internet are discussing. Theoretic comments that in prior information environments, the ability to pull an idea from the fringe to mass awareness used to take a lot of time. Now, this strategy, beloved by propagandists, occurs seemingly daily in the major news cycle, sometimes multiple times per day. Technological advances, like the increased sophistication of AI, makes it difficult to understand what is real and what is not in this confusing landscape of our current day media. And on top of all that, it's not just influencers trying to make money or US politicians trying to win elections. Nowadays, we also have to worry about the influence of governments outside of our own acting to destabilize our democracy. And listen, I think there are quite a few aspects of this new media and new media platforms that we're seeing that are good. I think information being democratized is a good thing. However, it's becoming more and more obvious that some guardrails should probably be put in place. Either way, my take is that the new form of getting information through the media is not better or worse than the traditional way. It's just different. And while something like the five filters from Chomsky and Herman may still be applicable to this new media structure, it takes a lot more digging to see the connections and layers than it once did. Well, that's all for today. I think I gave you enough to chew on there. Thank you so much for listening, and next time we're going to discuss the history behind right-wing media as we know it and how the thinkers of 80 years ago paved the path for the rhetoric we have today.